हरे सहनावतु सहनाभुनक्तु सहवीर्यंकरवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्त वृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे।
So section 95. Janamejaya said, O Brahmana, I have now heard from thee this great history of my ancestors. I had also heard from thee about the great monarchs that were born in this line. But I have not been gratified, this charming account being too short. Therefore be pleased, O Brahmana, to recite the delightful narrative just in detail, commencing from Manu, the Lord of creation. Who is there that will not be charmed with such an account, as it is sacred? The fame of these monarchs, increased by their wisdom, virtue, accomplishments, and high character, has so swelled as to cover the three worlds. Having listened to the history, sweet as nectar, of their liberality, prowess, physical strength, mental vigor, energy, and perseverance, I have not been satiated. Vaishampayana said, Hear then, O monarch, as I recite in full the auspicious account of thy own race, just as I heard it from Dwaipayana before. Daksha begot Aditi, and Aditi begot Vivasvat, and Vivasvat begot Manu, and Manu begot Ila, and Ila begot Pururavas, and Pururavas begot Ayus, and Ayus begot Nahusha, and Nahusha begot Yayati. And Nayati had two wives, namely Devayani, the daughter of Ushanas, and Sarmishta, the daughter of Rishaparvam. Here occurs a shloka regarding Yayati's descendants. Devayani gave birth to Yadu and Turvasu. Rishaparvam's daughter Sarmishta gave birth to Druhyu, Anu, and Puru. And the descendants of Yadu are the Yadavas, and of Purus the Pauravas. And Puru had a wife of the name Kaushalya, on whom he begot a son named Janamejaya, who performed three horse sacrifices and a sacrifice called Vishwajit. And then he entered into the woods. And Janamejaya had married Ananta, the daughter of Madhava, and begat upon her a son called Prachinvat. And the prince was so called because he had conquered all the eastern countries, up to the very confines of the region where the sun rises. So Prabhupada said Bengal is east, so the sun rises here and then goes around, right? So that means kind of like Eastern Asia. That's actually, technically speaking, in the Vedic, that's west. That's as far west as you can get. If you've ever been down in the Sundarban, like here, you see the sun will rise like 4:30 in the morning in the middle of summer. You know, Mangalartik, halfway through, the sun's up. But if you go down to the Sundarbans like that, which is straight down from here, then it rises even earlier. I think it's like 3 o'clock, it starts to get light. You know, you're out taking your bath, you know, before Mangalartik, and already the people are going to the field and taking the cows and plowing and everything. So that's the point. This is east, and then as it goes around, then it gets more and more west. So that means he would have conquered up to, you know, wherever like that. And Prachinvat married Asmaki, a daughter of the Yadavas, and begot upon her a son named Sanyati. And Sanyati married Varangi, the daughter of Drishavata, and begat upon her a son named Ahyanti. And Ahyanti married Banumati, the daughter of Kritavirya, and begat upon her a son named Sarvabhauma. And Sarvabhauma married Sunanda, the daughter of the Kekaya prince, having obtained her by force. And he begat upon her a son named Jayatsena, who married Shutashrava, the daughter of the Vidarbha king, and begat upon her Abhichinna. And Abhichinna also married another princess of Vidarbha, Maryada by name. And he begat on her a son named Adihan. And Adihan married Angi, and begat upon her Mahabhauma. And Mahabhauma married Suyagya, the daughter of Prasenajit. And of her was born Ayutanayi. And he was also called because he had performed a sacrifice at which the fat of an Ayuta, 10,000s of male beings, was required. Ayutanayati took for a wife Kama, the daughter of Prithushravas. And by her was born a son named Akrodana, who took to wife Karamba, the daughter of the king of Kalinga. And of her was born Devatiti. And Devatiti took for his wife Maryada, the princess of Videha. And of her was born a son named Arihan. And Arihan took to wife Sudevi, the princess of Anga. And upon her he begat a son named Riksha. And Riksha married Jwala, the daughter of Takshika. And he begat upon her a son of the name Matinara, who performed on the bank of the Saraswati the 12-year sacrifice said to be so efficacious. Right. On conclusion of the sacrifice, Saraswati appeared in person before the king and chose him for husband. And he begat upon her a son named Tansu. Here occurs a shloka descriptive of Tansu's descendants. Tansu was born of Saraswati by Matinara, and Tansu himself begat a son named Ilina on his wife, the princess Kalingi. Ilina begat on his wife Ratantare, five sons, of whom Dushmanta was the eldest. And Dushmanta took to wife Shakuntala, the daughter of Vishwamitra, and he begat upon her a son named Bharata. Here occurs two shlokas about Dushmanta's descendants. The mother is the sheath of flesh in which the father begets the son. Indeed, the father himself is the son. Therefore, O Dushmanta, support thy son and insult not Shakuntala. O God among men, the father himself becoming the son rescueth himself from hell. Shakuntala hath truly said that thou art the author of this child's being. It is for this, namely, because the son supported his child after hearing the above speech of the celestial messenger, that Shakuntala's son came to be called Bharata, the supported. And Bharata married Sunanda, the daughter of Sarvasena, the king of Kashi, and begat upon her the son named Bhumanyu. And Bhumanyu married Vijaya, the daughter of Dasarha. And he begat upon her a son, Suhotra, who married Suvarna, the daughter of Ikshvaku. To her was born a son named Hasti, who founded his city, which has therefore been called Hastinapura. And Hasti married Yashodhara, the princess of Trigarta. And of her was born a son named Vikuntana, who took for a wife Sudeva, the princess of Dasarha. And by her was born a son named Ajamida. And Ajamida had four wives, namely Raikei, Gandhari, Vishala, and Riksha. And he begat upon them 2,400 sons. But among them all, Suvarna became the perpetrator of the dynasty. And Samvarna took for his wife Tapati, the daughter of Vivasvat. And of her was born Kuru, who married Subangi, the princess of Dasarha. And he begat upon her a son named Vidurata, who took a wife Supriya, the daughter of Madhavas. And he begat upon her a son named Anasvan, And Anasvan married Amrita, the daughter of the Madhavas. And of her was born a son named Pariket, who took for his wife Suvasa, the daughter of the Vahudas, and begat upon her a son named Bhimasena. And Bhimasena married Kumari, the princess of Kaikeya, and begat upon her Pratishravas, whose son was Pratipa. And Pratipa married Sunanda, the daughter of Sivi, and begat upon her three sons, naming Devapi, Santanu, and Valika. And Devapi, while still a boy, entered the woods as a hermit. And Santanu became king. Here occurs a sloka in respect to Santanu. Those old men that were touched by this monarch not only felt an indescribable sensation of pleasure, but also became restored to youth. Therefore, this monarch was called Santanu. And Santanu married Garga, who bore him a son, Devavrata. Oh, married Ganga. Type it. It means a printing error, so you lost the bottom of the N. I was wondering, who is this Garga? And Santanu married Ganga, who bore him a son, Devavrata, who was afterwards called Bhishma. And Bhishma, moved by the desire of doing good to his father, got him married to Satyavati, who was also called Gandakali. And in her maidenhood she had a son by Parasara, named Dvaipayana. And upon her Santanu began two other sons named Chitrangada and Vichitravirya. And before they attained to majority, Chitrangada had been slain by the Gandharvas. But Vichitravirya became king and married the two daughters of the king of Kashi, named Amvika and Amvalika. But Chitravirya died childless. Then Satyavati began to think as to how the dynasty of Dushmanta might be perpetuated. Then she recollected the Rishi Dvaipayana. The latter coming before her asked, "What are thy commands?" She said, "Thy brother Vichitravirya hath gone to heaven childless. Beget virtuous children for him." Dvaipayana consented to this, begat three children, namely Dhritarashtra, Pandu, and Vidura. King Dhritarashtra had 100 sons by his wife Gandhari, in consequence of the boon granted by Dvaipayana. And amongst those 100 sons of Dhritarashtra, 4 became celebrated. They are Duryodhana, Dushasana, Vikarna, and Chitrasena. And Pandu had 2 jewels of wives, namely Kunti, also called Prita, and Madri. One day Pandu, while out a-hunting, saw a deer covering its mate. That was really a rishi in the form of a deer. Seeing the deer in that attitude, he killed it with his arrows before his desire was gratified. Pierced with the king's arrows, the deer quickly changed its form and became a rishi, and said unto Pandu, "O Pandu, thou art virtuous and acquainted also with the pleasure derived from the gratification of one's desires. My desire being unsatisfied, thou hast slain me. Therefore thou also, when so engaged, and before thou art gratified, shall die." Pandu, hearing this curse, became pale, and from that time would not go in unto his wives. Pandu was already pale. That's why he's called Pandu. Pandu means pale, so you can imagine if Pandu went pale, how pale that would be. Right? And he told them these words, "Through my own fault I have been cursed, but I have heard that for the childless there are no regions thereafter. Therefore he solicited Kunti to have offspring raised for him. And Kunti said, 'Let it be.' So she raised up offspring by Dharma, and she had Yudhishthir, by Marut, Bhima, and by Shakra, Arjuna. And Pandu, well pleased with her, said, 'This thy co-wife is also childless, therefore cause her also to bear children.' Kunti, saying, 'So be it,' imparted unto Madri the mantra of invocation. And on Madri were raised by the twin Ashwinis, the twins Nakula and Sahadev. And one day Pandu, beholding Madri bedecked with ornaments, had his desire kindled, and as soon as he touched her, he died. Madri ascended the funeral pyre with her lord. And she said unto Kunti, 'Let these twins of mine be brought up by thee with affection.' After some time, those five Pandavas were taken by the ascetics of the woods to Hastinapura, and there introduced to Bhimsena and Vidura. And after introducing them, the ascetics disappeared in the very sight of all. Right? Remember, this was explained before, no? Why they disappeared in front of everybody?
To give proof that they were the sons of Pandu and they weren't any common vicious saying this.
Yes. Right? So otherwise, if they came and said these are Pandu's sons, they may believe, may not believe. But having said all that, then right in front of them, they just disappear. Then they know, okay, these are not ordinary sages, so we should be very careful and accept their word, not offend them. Yeah. And after the conclusion of the speech of those ascetics, flowers were showered down upon the spot, and the celestial drums were also beaten in the skies. The Pandavas were then taken by Bhishma. They then represented the death of their father and performed his last honors duly. And as they were brought up there, Duryodhana became exceedingly jealous of them. And the sinful Duryodhana, acting like Rakshasa, tried various means to drive them away. Well, what must be can never be frustrated. So all Duryodhana's efforts proved futile. When Dhritarashtra sent them by an act of deception to Varanavata, and they went there willingly, there an endeavor was made to burn them to death, but it proved abortive owing to the warning counsels of Vidura. After that, the Pandavas slew Hidimba, and they then went to a town called Ekachakra. There they also slew a Rakshasa of the name Vaka and went to Panchala, and there obtained Draupadi for a wife. They returned to Hastinapura, and there they dwelt for some time in peace and begat children. And Yudhishthira begat Prativindya, Bhima, Sutasoma, Arjuna, Shrutakirti, Nakula, Satanika, and Sahadev, Shrutakarman. Besides these, Yudhishthira, having obtained for his wife Devaki, the daughter of Govasana of the Shaivya tribe, in a self-choice ceremony, begat upon her a son named Yaudheya. And Bhima also obtained for a wife Valandhara, the daughter of the king of Kashi, offering his own prowess as dower, and begat upon her a son named Saravaga. And Arjuna also, repairing to Dwaravati, brought away by force, Dwaravati means Dwarka, and brought away by force Subhadra, the sweet speech sister of Vasudeva, and returned in happiness to Hastinapura. And he begat upon her a son named Abhimanyu, endued with all accomplishments, and dear to Vasudeva himself. And Nakula attained for his wife Karenu Mati, the princess of Chedi, and begat upon her a son named Niramitra. And Sahadeva also married Vijaya, the daughter of Dyutimat, the king of Madra, and obtaining her in a self-choice ceremony, and begat upon her a son named Suhutra.
Self-choice ceremony means?
Yes, Svayamvara, right? Self-choice means that's mutual, that's Gandharva. But when it's a ceremony, self-choice, then that would be Svayamvara, right? Because it's not, the boy has already showed his interest by just showing up there, right? But it's up to her to choose because there's so many have showed up, right? But Gandharva, then it's just one-on-one. So it's not, it's a ceremony, but it's not as such, it's not so formal. Oh, here's another Suhutra. Yeah, and then Sahadev begat on Vijaya a son named Suhutra, and Bhimsena had some time before begat upon Hidimba a son named Ghatotkacha. These are the 11 sons of the Pandavas. Amongst them all, Abhimanyu was the perpetrator of the family. He married Uttara, the daughter of Virata, who brought forth a dead child, whom Kunti took upon her lap at the command of Vasudeva, who said, "I will revive this child of 6 months." And though born before time, having been burnt by the fire of Ashwatthaman's weapon, and therefore deprived of strength and energy, he was revived by Vasudeva and endued with strength, energy, and prowess. And after reviving him, Vasudeva said, "Because this child hath been born in an extinct race, therefore he shall be called Parikit." And Parikit married Madravati, thy mother, O king, and thou art born to her, O Janamijaya. Thou hast also begotten two sons on thy wife, Vapustama, named Satanika and Sankulkarna. And Satanika also hath begotten one son, named Ashwamedhata, upon the princess of Videha. So why would Janamijaya know this? Right, the line all the way down to, now he's talking to he's talking to Janamijaya, and that is Vaishampayana. Why would he know Janamijaya's grandchildren and his wife and where she's from and everything? Yes, Puranas. Right? You understand? So this idea, Purana means old, but that's because you start from old and then you come up to now. But technically, what is old? Yes? Huh? Can't remember. Okay. So what is old is then anything that's past. Right? It means only the present is fresh. As soon as it's moved from the present to the past, which means only a moment, then it's old. So anything that's going on right now is actually technically old. You understand? Right? And then future is anything from a moment ahead of now, you know, and extending however far you want to go. So present's actually only a moment. Right? It's a very small gap there, right? So that time is the time. So up to this time, one should know. But at the same time, you should know what's going on this moment, because that's the moment. That's what you actually have to deal with. And then the future also is explained by the Shastra, right? But that means history means up to now. Right? Thus have I, O King, recited the history of the descendants of Puru and of the Pandavas. This excellent, virtue-increasing, and sacred history should ever be listened to by the vow-observing Brahmins, by Kshatriyas devoted to the practices of their order and ready to protect the subjects, by Vaishyas with attention, and by Shudras with reverence, whose chief occupation is to wait upon the three other orders. Brahmanas conversant in the Vedas and other persons who, with attention and reverence, recite this sacred history or listen to it when recited, conquer the heavens and attain to the abode of the blessed. They are also respected and adored by the gods, brahmanas, and other men. This holy history of Bharata hath been composed by the sacred and illustrious Vyasa. Veda-knowing brahmins and other persons who with reverence and without malice hear it recited, earn great religious merits and conquer the heavens. Though sinning, they are not disgraced by anyone. Here occurs a shloka. This Bharata is equal unto the Vedas. It is holy and excellent. It bestoweth wealth, fame, and life. Therefore it should be listened to by men with rapt attention. Right? Rapt attention means we're happy to hear, not that, oh no, here's another one of those lineages that's going to be boring, right? Like that. Section 96. Yeah. Okay. Any questions on this last? Yes.
You're talking about Parikshit being named, and he was revived after. Is anyway the scene just Kalpa Beda? And why would Vasudeva write Mahabharata and Bhagavatam in two different, not in the same Kalpa?
Why would he write Bhagavatam and Mahabharata in two different Kalpas?
Why would it not be the same?
Why would it not be the same kalpa? He's written the Mahabharata in the same kalpa as the Bhagavatam. But it's not necessarily that the stories that are told have to be from the same kalpa. You know what I'm saying? That's not important. Because the point is to get the point across. So it's just like you want to cook, you have so many utensils, use the one that works for what you want to cook.
Right? And next time you cook, it may be something different. Or you go to cook, but then that utensil's not available. You use something else that'll work also. Right? So the point is what story will best illustrate what question has been asked, that story will be told. Does that make sense? So depending upon what you want to bring out. Right? Mahabharata, you're not bringing out as much the dependency upon the Lord. You know, but at the same time, you want to affect the greatness of the Lord, right? So that kind of a thing, that maybe the relationship with the Lord is not as much understood. Therefore, you'll tell of the churning of the ocean where the mountain is not brought by the demigods, but it's brought by Garuda, and then it's immediately placed on Kurma, and then they start the churning. So you can see is everything's only happening because of the Lord, but that interaction with the Lord and the devotees isn't brought out as much there. Right? But then we see that then in the Bhagavatam, then they'll show how the demigods, you know, are trying to bring it, but they can't. Right? And then they become crushed, and then Vishnu then brings them back to life. Then Garuda carries it. Right? So Garuda did carry it, so he just kind of finessed that part about the demigods carrying it and not being able to do it. Right? 33 million demigods get out, they can't carry the mountain. Right? Garuda on his own can carry it. Right. So this brings out the prowess of Krishna, of Vishnu, and the demigods not, but a lot of people listening to the Mahabharata may or may not be convinced of Krishna's supremacy. So they might be worshipping demigods, which they shouldn't be, but they are. And so that faith has to be maintained. So that's why it said the Bhagavatam is for the Paramahamsas, because that's for people who, then their purpose is just knowing Krishna. That makes sense? So depending upon, you'll tell the story or tell that part of the story. Right? So it means that they put the mountain into the ocean, they churned it, it sank. Right? And so then having sank, then Kurma appeared, then they ask him if he would carry them like that. Right? But you can say, you know, and they, so you can just say that Garuda brought the mountain, because that's actually when the mountain came, and, you know, they placed it on the back of Kurma, and they churned the ocean, because that's actually when churning happened. Right? Demigods bringing the mountain, churning without Kurma as the pivot, neither worked. So you can leave them out of the story. You understand? So depending upon what you want, then you tell the story, you know, or you use one from a different kalpa. You know, like in Bhagavatam, you have two stories of Varahadev, one white, Sweta Varaha, and then one red, like that. So both of them.
How would you explain to academics who don't believe that there's authenticity in the Shastra because they see discrepancies and differences, and so they think that...
How do you explain to academics who can't handle that? If you can handle it, then you read Krishna Sandarbha by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And then, without telling an untruth, you just brush it aside. Okay? So he tells how to do that. He gives examples. But that means that he's not... But if you'll notice, his brushing it aside is not an untruth. He's maintaining the truth, he's only saying it in such a way that, you know, it works. You know what I'm saying? Like you say, that'd be an example. Example that comes to mind is in another work of his where he's talking to academics and intellectuals, where he starts off saying that the hells mentioned in the scriptures are imaginary, right? And so then they think, okay, now he's not one of these, you know, traditional contemplative dogmatic scholars, but he's a very broad-minded, you know, intellectual here. Right? That's what you'll gain from this. So you could say, he said his imagination means it's not real. Right? But what is imagination if you actually look at it, right? There's the contextual, how you say, concept of a or usage of a word, but it's not necessarily the actual meaning of the word, right? You know, like somebody now says, you know, that's bad, it means it's good, right? But the real meaning of the word bad means it's not good. But in this text, means someone who's not good, that's called good. Right? You know, does that make sense? You know, they're not going to go up to the Mona Lisa generally and say, wow, that's bad. You know? Yeah.
Actually, the early suffix early in English is locative suffix.
Eddie?
The suffix early, imaginary, you say.
Oh.
Locative suffix actually, originally.
Oh, means.
It's something different.
Uh-huh.
So that means place where you imagine things.
Yeah, place where you imagine things. You get it? So
the hell is an imaginary place. That means the place where people imagine that they are.
Yeah, because they don't have a gross spot. Because, see, imagination means that which happens in the mind, right? But in hell, you don't have a gross body. You actually put a covering on your subtle body. So your subtle body is able to, like the gross body, you inflict pain on it. The subtle body feels it. So here there's no gross body. They put this other very, very tough, it's more strong body than the physical body, because the physical body wouldn't handle the tortures. So they put this other very strong body on. And then, so all of the things that you're, that is through the mental, the subtle body that you're experiencing. So technically you would call that mental or imaginary. But it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's existing, but you're experiencing it through the mind. So then by him saying it's imaginary, then is, in the scholars' minds, then saying he's rejecting the dogmatic approach of the scriptures. But for the Vaishnavas, they understand exactly what he meant. And how clever he was that on an issue that's not important, right? It's more important that they accept God and service to God, love for God, the process of chanting, than to get stuck up on the thing that they can't accommodate, the time frames or the various species of life or interplanetary travel. Right? So therefore he gives ways that all these different things that are points of contention, how you just sidetrack them, but they're not wrong. But that's why I said if you can handle it, because if you also have a problem with them, then reading these, then you'll think he's giving you an excuse to not have faith in it. Right? Because that book was written to show preachers how to preach in these kind of environments. Because he's the first one who bridged between the traditional culture and the modern culture. Right? Before that, everybody was dealing, means your modern culture was the Mohammedans in that, but they still basically followed a similar culture and value system. But then with the East India Company coming, then you had that European culture. It was very, very different, because they didn't have that kind of faith in that. So he showed how to talk to that group. You know, the so-called, you know, broad-minded, you know, how you say, what's the term they always use for when they write and stuff, that you look at it from an objective point of view by criticizing it?
Phenomenologists.
Yeah, like that, or, oh, it's the critical edition, right? But that's the point, is if you are objective, then you could be appreciative. But no, you have to find fault in it. Then that means you're objective. But if you're really objective, then what's useful you keep, and what's not useful you throw. Right? Okay. Section 96. Vaishampayana said, there was a king known by the name of Mahabhisha, born in the race of Ikshvaku. Ah, now you get the history. He was the lord of all the earth, and was truthful in speech, and of true prowess. By 1,000 horse sacrifices and 100 Rajasuyas, he had gratified the chief of the celestials and ultimately attained to heaven. 1,000 horse sacrifices. You only need 100 to become Indra. And Rajasuya was, one of them was done before by, I think, Harishchandra. And he was in the heavenly planets and no one else was. Right? All the other kings are in Pitri Loka. So then Pandu requested Narad Muni to ask Yudhisthira to perform a Rajasuya, because then that would mean they would go to the heavenly planets, you know, where Indra is, and it would take him along with them. Pandu would also go. Right, so here he's done 100 Rajasuyas. Right, so this had to be in a time when they lived a bit longer, right? Because most of these sacrifices, much of them take like a year to perform. Setting it up and everything, like you have to plow the land at a particular time and start the kunda at a particular time, and these kind of sacrifices, shrameda, then they there's like five layers to the kunda, like that. So they build one at one time, and then the bricks are all handmade, and then they're built at another time. The priest does all the square bricks and all the triangular bricks that are needed, then that his wife has to make, and then, you know, dry them. So the whole thing takes like 9 months to even set up the yajna. And then you have actually performing it. That's why it said is in 100 years, if someone performed 100 ashramedas, because you wouldn't be able to do it any quicker. Right? Does that make sense? So to do 1,000 of them plus the Rajasuya, then means he would have been alive and reigning as king for a long time. One day the celestials had assembled together and were worshipping Brahman. Many royal sages and King Mahabisha were also present on the spot. And Ganga, the queen of rivers, also came there to pay her adoration to the grandsire, you know, to Brahma. And her garments, white as the beams of the moon, was displaced by the action of the wind. And as her person became exposed, the celestials bent down their heads. But the royal sage Mahabisha rudely stared at the queen of rivers. And Mahabisha was for this cursed by Brahman, who said, "Wretch, as thou hast forgotten thyself at the sight of Ganga, thou shalt be reborn on earth. But thou shalt again and again attain to these regions. And she too shall be born in the world of men, and shall do thee injuries. But when thy wrath shall be provoked, thou shalt then be freed from my curse." Vaishampayana continued, "King Mahabisha then recollected all the monarchs and ascetics on earth, and wished to be born as the son to Pratipa of great prowess. And the queen of rivers too, seeing King Mahabisha lose his firmness, went away, thinking of him wistfully. And on her way, she saw those dwellers in heaven, the Vasus, also pursuing the same path. And the queen of rivers, beholding them in the predicament, asked them, 'Why look ye so dejected? Ye dwellers in heaven, is everything right with you?' But those celestials, the Vasus, answered her, saying, 'O queen of rivers, we have been cursed for a venial fault by the illustrious Vasishta in anger. The foremost of excellent rishis, Vasishta, had been engaged in his twilight adorations, and seated as he was, he could not be seen by us. We crossed him in ignorance. Therefore, in wrath, he hath cursed us, saying, "Be ye born among men." It is beyond our power to frustrate that what hath been said by the utterance of Brahma. Therefore, O river, thyself becoming a human female, make us, the Vasus, thy children. O amiable one, we are unwilling to enter the womb of any human female." Thus addressed, the queen of rivers told them, "Be it so," and asked them, "On earth, who is the foremost of men whom ye will make your father?" The Vasus replied, "On earth, unto Pratipa shall be born a son, Shantanu, who will be a king of worldwide fame." Ganga then said, "Ye celestials, what is exactly my wish?" "Oh, that is exactly my wish, which ye sinless ones have expressed. I shall indeed do good to that Santanu. That is also your desire, as just expressed." So what we see here is that the celestials that have to be born on earth at some point, so they want to be born in good families, right? It's mentioned that Prabhupada said that the demigods are waiting in line to be born in the devotee families, right? So that means souls that are of good character and quality, then they're choosy who becomes their parents, right? Does that make sense? So if you're choosy how you have children, you can get these high-grade personalities as children. But if you're indiscriminate and don't care about the proper rituals and anything like that, then you get something common. Does that make sense? But the point is here, as we can see, is all of them are worried. Ganga's worried, you know, who she's going to be dealing with. The Vasus are worried. Mahabisha is worried. Right? So that's not just them. That's all of them. Right? You see, Yayati, when he was falling, he said, let me be amongst those who are virtuous and you know, truthful. Does that make sense? So it's very important. Remember, you're going to have to take care of the thing for like 20 years before it gets it together. Right? So it's your choice. You want it to be a decent 20 years, or you want it to be a problem. Right? The Vasus then said, it behooveth thee, Ganga Devi, to throw thy children after birth into the water, so that, O thou of three courses, celestial, terrestrial, and subterranean. Right? In other words, she flows on the heavenly planets, she flows on earth, and she flows through the lower planets. Right? So therefore she's called thou of three courses. Right? We may be rescued soon without having to live on earth for any length of time. Ganga then answered, I shall do what ye desire, but in order that this connection with me may not be entirely fruitless, provide ye that one son at least may live. The Vasus then replied, we shall each contribute an eighth part of our respective energies. With the sum thereof, thou shalt have one son according to thy and his wishes. But this son shall not beget any children on earth. Therefore that son of thine, endued with great energy, shall be childless. The Vasus, making this arrangement with Ganga, went away without waiting to the place they liked. Oh, I see. Making an arrangement with Ganga, went away without waiting to the place they liked. I need a few comments here. Any questions on that? Yeah. Why wouldn't he have children? Because then you get more entangled, right? Also, I guess they wouldn't want the line to continue, and then they to have involvement, because if then they have family on earth, like you see, Indra and Surya, they're always coming down and having to deal with Karna and Arjuna, and you know, get involved in the human politics. All right, so they didn't want to. All right, so then you know, then their line will be childless. All right, because they just wanted to stay a short time, so they didn't want them to get entangled. So then, like that, does that make sense? Because yeah. It said real entanglement happens when you beget children. Up to that point, you may be, you know, involved, but as soon as you beget children, that's when the knot of material existence becomes tightened, because then you're completely like stuck like that, because so many duties, so many considerations, you can't not deal with them, right? You don't deal with them, they're sinful. So that's where the real involvement comes, right? But you know, for devotees, then that's all connected to Krishna. So then even that helps one get out of the material, you know. But that's because you know what you're doing, because you know how to connect it. Right? But otherwise, for anybody else, that's when they really become entangled. Right? Because when you have children, then you're going to have they're going to get, you have to get them married, so it's the whole thing that. Then you're going to have all those relatives and more families, right? You already have a family because you've married somebody, an extra family. Now your children, when they get married, they're going to have extra family. And then those children of those other families, they also get married, and they have. So then you end up with hundreds and hundreds of relatives. Well, before there was only two of you, right? But as soon as you have a child, then immediately there's hundreds of relatives. Right? Like that. So that's the whole thing. Ah, okay. Section 97. Vaishampayana said, there was a king of the name of Pratipa, who was kind to all creatures. He spent many years in ascetic penances at the source of the river Ganga. They accomplished in lovely Ganga one day, assuming the form of a beautiful female, and rising from the waters, made up to the monarch. The celestial maiden, endued with ravishing beauty, approached the royal sage engaged in ascetic austerities, and sat upon his right thigh that was, for manly strength, a veritable psaltery. Right? Psalteries are big, I think they do, like when they do, at least in India, the telephone poles and other things like that. Those are sol, you know, big, solid. You don't get wood harder than sol, right? All your door frames are sol. I think this bridge is sol, right? Right? It can stay out in the weather, right? Any other wood stays outside, it rots, right? Like that plank over there, our famous plank. That one's been there unfinished and just sitting as it is for years now. Right, so that's Saul. Right, so when you say manly strength like Saul, then you can understand it's very powerful. Right, okay. Does that make sense? No. Okay, so now we know what it means. It's like a Saul tree, right? Ladies, it said like a banana tree, right? Because it's taken off. Right, it's there, but you can push. It gives, right? Salt trees don't give. Right? So you know, get it straight. You know. Yeah, she had thighs like a salt tree. Yeah, that you would leave, you know, and maybe Hidimbi had that, you know. So. Yeah, but you know, for Bhima that may have been good, you know. You know, she's tough. Right? Where are we? Ah. Maiden of handsome face had so sat upon his lap. The monarch said unto her, O amiable one, what dost thou desire? What shall I do? Right? He didn't say, you know, hey, what are you doing here? Beat it, right? You know, lady. What can I do? Because he's a king. Kings are supposed to take care of people, right? So then they've come, and so that's his duty to take care. The damsel answered, I desire thee, O king, for my husband. O foremost one of the Kurus, be mine. To refuse a woman coming of her own accord is never applauded by the wise, right? Because you see in the Vedic weddings that the best of them are where the girl's family approaches the boy's family. Does that make sense? Because the point is if the girl's interest is there, then everything works. Does that make sense? Because girls don't function just purely on duty. Men can, girls don't. Right? There has to be an interest. There has to be an attraction. Right? Then they'll work. Right? His relationship, they'll function. Just out of duty, without any, in other words, existence or sutta is not a feminine principle, right? That's masculine. Feminine depends upon that. Does that make sense? So therefore, then you may find this. It's a very, 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 the only reason I bring it up, because it's continuing with the varies, very, 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 very common, extremely common, I mean quite common, that it is one of the most common. Is that there's a girl that's interested in you, that's very qualified in everything, but you want some other, you know, hot number that you think that's going to be the one instead. But as it's said here by Ganga Devi herself, right? This is horse's mouth, right, or here. Damsel's mouth, right here. Okay? It's the one that approaches, it's qualified. Doesn't mean one that approaches is not qualified. That's what's important, not what you think is interesting looking. Right? Because if it's out there that's interesting looking out on the street, it's interesting looking to a lot of other people also. You know what I'm saying? So that's why we're very careful in this. That's the only reason we brought up this, you know, how you say, extremely rare manifestation of bewilderment. Does that make sense? Yes? No? So therefore, then it also throws out another element that therefore you don't have to worry about looking around trying to figure out what's available or what you're going to get. You just wait. And if you're qualified, then naturally it attracts, right? Right? You know, it's just like money attracts money. So qualified boy attracts qualified girl. Yes? No?
Yes.
Bogus boy becomes attracted to bogus girl, right? Right? Does that make sense? Right? Very set formulas. They always work. So, like that. Pratipa, to refuse a woman coming of her own accord is never applauded by the wise. Pratipa answered, O thou of the fairest complexion, moved by lust, I never go into others' wives or women that are not of my order. This indeed is my virtuous vow. The maiden rejoined, I am not inauspicious or ugly. I am every way worthy of being enjoyed. I am a celestial maiden of rare beauty. I desire thee for my husband. Refuse me not. All right. What does it say? What is it? Inauspicious or ugly, right? Okay. Okay. To this Pratipa answered, I am, O damsel, abstaining from that course to which thou incitest me. If I break my vow, sin will overwhelm and kill me. O thou of the fairest complexion, thou hast embraced me, sitting on my right thigh. But, O timid one, know that this is the seat for daughters and daughters-in-law. The left lap is for the wife, but thou hast not accepted that. Therefore, O best of women, I cannot enjoy thee as an object of desire. Be my daughter-in-law, I accept thee for my son. The damsel then said, so this applies only in girls, not boys, right? I remember there was this whole big confusion, probably still going on, about how you have Nisringadev and Prahlad sitting on his left lap when the left thigh is for wives. You know, but that's if you're girls, then it's like that. But if you're boys, it doesn't matter, right? As we see is that when Maharaj Uttanapada, then you had Uttama and you had Dhruva. So Uttama was sitting on one lap, Dhruva wanted to sit on the other lap. So he wasn't thrown off saying, you know, hut, this is the lap for the ladies. No, that was just, you know, that the wife threw him off because she wasn't born of him. Right? Does that make sense? So don't worry which thigh Prahlad Maharaj is sitting on in Lord Nisringadev. Okay? Like that. Don't worry that it's a thing, right? Right, most restrictions only come in when you add women. If there's no women, there's very minimal restrictions. As soon as they're involved, then so many things start happening. Right? Yes? Which form of Nisringadev does Prahlad Maharaj sit on his lap? The form called Prahlad Nisringa. You know, in other words, he's come out of the pillar. That's Stanu Nisringa, right? And when he comes out, he has eight arms. Then, when he finds Hiranyakashipu, then he puts him on his lap. He kills him, and then he manifests two more arms to pick up, you know, the entrails and put them around his neck as a garland. Right? So he has 10 hands there. So 8 hand, 10 hand. Then you have when the army then gets a little bit annoyed that the Nrisimhadev just killed their, you know, their master, then they attack him, and then he manifests 1,000 arms, and then, you know, kills them all with his nails, right? Then, after that, he sits down on the throne of Hiranyakashipu, and sitting there, then he'll generally manifest forearm form, right? Then, because the demigods, you know, are all extremely afraid, right? Because, you know, they know that they're sometimes bad also. And so then God has come to, you know, establish religious principles. They're not sure that he's not going to, you know, get out his nails, you know, for them also. So they get very, very worried. So then he has to be calmed down because he's so angry no one can even look at him. Even Lakshmi can't figure out who is this, you know. You know, I've seen, you know, every form of my husband, but I haven't seen this one, you know, so I don't know what, you know, what mood this is. So then Narad Muni then takes Prahlad and brings him before Nrisimhadev. So seeing his devotee, because Prahlad's not afraid of him, then he becomes half peaceful, right? Peaceful enough that, you know, the demigods aren't worried that, you know, and further destruction is going to occur, right? But not peaceful enough that Lakshmiji can actually relate, right? So therefore then Prahlad sits there, talks and then sits on his lap after offering prayers. Then after he becomes completely peaceful from Prahlad there in the interaction, then only Lakshmi comes, right? Does that make sense? So it's a forearm form where he's peaceful, but not fully peaceful, right? Not peaceful enough for Lakshmi to relate. So that's why then the forms of the Ugra forms, then the ladies don't worship, because the Lord's without Lakshmi, right? So if he's without Lakshmi, how would the lady be there? And also Grihasthas don't worship, because the Grihastha has a wife, he's with. So how would he worship a form of the Lord who's without? You know what I'm saying? In other words, he has his wife, he's enjoying that interaction, so how would he approach the Lord? Does that make sense? So that's why only those without a wife, you know, then they worship the Ugra forms. Does that make sense? And women. So it's not a matter of, oh, we want to, or, oh, that's discriminatory. It's just the way the Lord likes it. It's practical. Right? Does that make sense? Does that make, you know? So that's it's just the way it is. It's not, yes.
So what is the day before Yoga Nidra?
Then that's after that. Then
Yeah,
Lakshmi Nrisimha will be first, because he's still there and it's also very formal. So when Lakshmi comes, then it's still quite formal and all the demigods are there and everything. Then after that, then it goes more and more peaceful. So the most peaceful is the Yoga Nrisimha. Like that, where he's sitting and he has that yoga belt, you know, and he sits there and then Lakshmi's there. So that's the most peaceful. So he's the nicest to deal with and everything like that. Like that. So you see also the number two temple in the Ramanuja line. You have Sri Rangam, or you have Arangaji, right? It means Lord laying on the serpent, you know, laying there and everything. But in Melkote, the main deity, means they have a deity, Vishnu deity, in the forearm form, but they're very prominent as they have a Yoga Nrisimha deity. Very, very nice Yoga Nrisimha deity. Like that. So he's the most peaceful. But just because he's peaceful doesn't mean he doesn't protect. It just means his interaction and dealings are the most. But others, like that it gets more and more, a little bit more. You have to be more careful. Like that, yeah?
Maharaj, what would be the form of Laddu Gopal?
When does Nrisimhadev take the form of Laddu Gopal?
The question was, what do we do? Because also Laddu Gopal is not with like Radharani or somebody like that, so can they worship Laddu Gopal?
Can the women worship Laddu Gopal? Yes, because that's when they're worshipping as child. That's why in our line we don't worship Laddu Gopal. even though he's very popular, but we don't, it's not our line. We worship Krishna as a teenager, an adolescent. That's what we worship. Kishore, Kishori. But that is for, that's the deity of like the Vallabha line, where their relationship with Krishna is parental ras. So they want to be assistants to Mother Jashoda and Nanda Baba and like that. So they have, you know, a swing for him, and they put all kinds of toys in that, and they deal with him as a child. You know, cook for him, you know, no chili in his food and everything like that. You go to Nathdwar, and what they cook for the deity is no chili in it. Even in Puri, they cook without chili and put it in afterwards. Like that. So, like that. I think also in Guru Vayur, because he's a small child, they cook without chili. You know, but it's only the tough guys with the sal tree legs that then, you know, the chili comes out. You know, stuff like that. Okay. Sal's also a bit bumpy, you know, kind of scratchy. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.